We made it. Exodus chapter 1, we made it. We begin our chapter by chapter, verse by verse study through the second book of the Bible, Exodus. It's 40 chapters long, and it covers about 40 years of the history of the nation of Israel. It was written by Moses, who wrote the first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And just as the theme of Genesis could be seen through the title of the book, so the same is the case with the book and the theme of Exodus. Genesis, we said there in Genesis 1, means origins or beginnings. And we saw that that was what the book was all about. It was about the origins, the beginnings of all things. Well, everything except for God. We settled that at the start, right? In the beginning, God created everything as we know it, because in the beginning, in our beginning, God was already there. But we saw the beginnings of many things, just as the title of the book suggests: the beginning of the planet, the beginning of the plant life, the beginning of animal life, the beginning of human life, the beginning of marriage, the institution of marriage, the beginning of sin, the beginning of death, the beginning of war, and on we go until we get to the end of Genesis, and the whole thing lands us looking straight up at a coffin. The book ends us in death, death because of sin. That's where the fall lands us. It's a bleak reality, it's a bleak end. And then we have this tiny little time gap between the book of Genesis and Exodus, this tiny little time gap of about 350 to 400 years. And now we come to the book of Exodus, which is a Latin title, Exodus, and it means escape or exit. And we see that that tips us off about what the book really is themed around. It becomes spiritually our roadmap to exit our bondage of slavery and find redemption. So really, right there is the prominent theme of the book, redemption. In this book, we're going to get a crash course in redemption through the blood of the Lamb. That thought, in all of the vital doctrines necessary for that entire concept of redemption through the blood of the Lamb, we're going to find it here in the book of Exodus. We're going to see a man named Moses who serves as a deliverer and an Old Testament type for our New Testament deliverer, Jesus. Another important point that I would like to make in our introduction to the book is the fact that this was written approximately 4,300 years ago. Pardon me, 3,400 years ago. 3,400 years ago. It's an old book. It's an ancient book. And I guess I can understand why some might question why modern thinkers would want to study such an old book, and what possible benefit could modern thinkers get from studying such an old book. But luckily for us, New Testament Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 that let me slow down here. I'm getting ahead of myself. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, he spends the first 10 verses talking about the events and the stories in the book of Exodus. And then in verse 11, here's what the Apostle Paul says about specifically the book of Exodus. He says, All these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. So Paul says it right there. Paul speaks to New Testament saints and he says, read the book of Exodus. Learn the lessons in it. And if you'll do that, if you'll glean the spiritual lessons in the book, it's going to save you from a lot of destruction and a lot of heartbreak. So that's what I'm going to do for the next 40 weeks or so. I'm going to study through this book, and as I study through this book, I'm going to fine-tune my relationship with Christ. And I hope you'll continue to join me through this journey for the same purpose as I have in my study. Let's begin with Exodus chapter 1, verse 1. Now, these are the names of the children of Israel who came to Egypt. Each man and his household came with Jacob. Verse 2. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. 3. Issachar, Zebulun. These were the children of Jacob with his wife Leah. And these are listed in birth order. That's where Leah's kids stop. And now the next one is Benjamin. And of course, we know that was Jacob's son through Rachel. Joseph was also one of the sons of Jacob and Rachel. And you'll notice he's not listed here. And the reason for that is because this list that you're getting is the list of souls that, as the scripture just told us, came with Jacob. Joseph was already in Egypt. This is the list of people that came with Jacob. So Joseph was already there. He's not listed in this. Verse 4, Dan, Naphtali. These were the sons of Jacob and Bilhah, which was Rachel's handmaid. So we started with the wives, Leah first, then Rachel. Now we're going to the handmaids. This is Rachel's handmaid. Then we have Gad and Asher. These were the sons of Jacob and Zilpah, which was Leah's handmaid. That's all found in Genesis 29 and Genesis 30. And now verse 5, all those who were descendants of Jacob were 70 persons, for Joseph was in Egypt already. Verse 6, and Joseph died, all his brothers, and all that generation. 7, but the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly, multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty, and the land, not just Goshen where they started out, but the whole land of Egypt was filled with them. Now, verse 7 shows us the fulfillment of God's words, but it leaves us with a question about God's methods. The promise of God to make Abraham's seed an innumerably great nation has been driven into our brains as we've studied through the book of Genesis. We saw that promise creeping up over and over. That promise was given to Abraham multiple times. That promise was given to Isaac. That promise was given to Jacob. So we've got that in our heads, and we come to Exodus chapter 1, verse 7. We read this statement and we say, wow, that's great. God has fulfilled, or we can clearly see him beginning to fulfill that promise. This is a large number of people. But why did he do the things that he did? Why did he choose the methods he chose? Why did God choose to do everything this way? Why did God choose to promise them the land of Canaan, stick them in the land of Canaan, then pull them out of the land of Canaan and push them in down into Egypt? And now, as we get to Exodus, what God is doing is he's beginning the process of moving them out of Egypt and back into the promised land. Why didn't God just leave the nation of Israel in the promised land to begin with? Why all the work? Why all the runaround? Why the detours? Well, I don't know if you remember this, but we actually covered this in the book of Genesis, but I think it bears repeating. I want to take you back real quick to Genesis 15 so that we can all see this. In Genesis chapter 15, verses 5 through 12, God promised to turn Abraham's family into a great nation. And God promised the family of Abraham, the family of Jacob, the promised land as a possession. And now we get to verse 13, and from verses 13 through 16, we start to see something very, very interesting to me, very intriguing. Look at this. I'm going to read this to you. Verse 13, Genesis 15. Then he said to Abraham, Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs. He's speaking about Egypt. And will serve them, and they will afflict them 400 years. And also the nation whom they serve I will judge. Afterward they shall come out with great possessions. But in the fourth generation, that is after about 400 years or so in Egypt, they shall return here to Canaan, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. So first, as we read that, we just have to acknowledge the fact that this was in fact God's plan to do this. Stick them in Canaan, pluck them out of Canaan, stick them into Egypt, and now Exodus 1, begin the process of plucking them up out of Exodus and bringing them back into Canaan. It was absolutely, without a doubt, God's purpose and God's plan. This was not just God responding to the precipitation problems globally. He could have handled that a different way. He could have continued to pour out the rain there in the land of Canaan as that 7-year global famine took place, even as he seems to continue to pour out the rain in southwestern Pennsylvania. It's too much for even the farmers. But the Lord could have chose different methods instead. This is for sure what he chose. He prophesied it, and in that passage, he gives us really two reasons why the detour. Two reasons why he wanted to take the nation into Egypt for 400 years. Number one, it was to prepare his people of promise for the land of promise. See, in God's omniscience, he knew that the nation would not be as strong and would not be as prosperous if he just left them there in Canaan for 400 years. He knew that without that trip to Egypt, they just would not be the same. As it turns out, it would seem that God wanted to use Egypt as sort of a nursery for the nation. You know, they'd have the protection of the unrivaled Egyptian army. They'd get bottle fed from all of Joseph's wealth of supplies there in Egypt. And when it came time to depart from Egypt, God would judge Egypt. We just read that. God would judge Egypt, and they'd end up leaving Egypt with all of Egypt's stuff. So they'd be nursed into great number, and they'd be nudged out with great possessions. But there was another reason, too. We just read it. It wasn't just to prepare his people of promise for the land of promise, but it was to prepare the land of promise for the people of promise. So he's accomplishing two things with their time in Egypt. He's preparing the people for the land, but he's also preparing the land for the people. The land was not ready for Israel's sovereign settlement. There were Amorites or Canaanites that would need to be permanently moved from the land before the nation of Israel could settle in. Now, you probably know they were a wretched and wicked people. The depths of their depravity and perversion are so difficult to speak about that I won't speak about it in this kind of setting. So you'll have to go home and look that up for yourself. But these were a wicked and evil people. They were a scourge to society, and they needed to go, no doubt about it. The influence that they were having on the world around them was just horrible. So, like you would do with a rabid dog, the Canaanites needed put down. I know it sounds cruel and not everybody could do it, but if that dog is rabid, you know that dog is going to die anyway. So for the safety of people around, you put the dog down. That's what needed done with the Amorites. That's what needed done with the Canaanites. But check this out. As wicked as they were, as perverse as they were, as depraved as they were, what does God do? He extends unfathomable mercy to them. He gives them 400 years to course correct. 400 years. That is important to know in advance, because if you just skip right to the section where God turns the nation of Israel loose on the Canaanites and says, go destroy every single one of them and inhabit the land. If you skip right to that section, you might say, whoa, God's a little mean. God's a little hot-tempered. But you'd be missing the fact that God moved his people out of the land. And what he was doing was, for those 400 years, he was raising up the IDF, the Israeli Defensive Forces. He was raising up a mighty people that could come in and displace the Canaanites. But that whole time, what God was also doing was extending a great big window of mercy, so that at any time, if the Canaanites repented, if they turned from their wickedness, if they course corrected the disastrous path that they were on as a society, what would God have done? He would have saved them. That's what he did with the Assyrians under Jonah's evangelistic campaign. He would have done the same thing. But as you know, they would not turn. They would not repent. So that is not a hot-tempered God that you're going to see in the future. That is a God of extreme patience. Let me ask you, when was the last time you were patient with someone for 400 years? You weren't, for multiple reasons. Well, until you're patient with someone for 400 years, don't be so bold as to attempt to pass judgment on God. That is extreme mercy. I know this. I would not have waited 400 years, but God did. His mercy is extremely difficult to fathom. Verse 8. Now there arose a new king, or more accurately, a new pharaoh over Egypt. And that would be Seti the First. We mentioned him last week, I believe, or 2 weeks ago, I guess. So there arose a new pharaoh over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And let this verse be a lesson to us. This is what happens when you forget the history of your own nation. If this guy just knew the history of his own nation, if he just knew the history of Egypt, do you think he'd have this approach with Joseph? If he understood the history, the true history of Egypt, he would understand that Joseph coming to the land of Egypt and the family of Israel was the best thing that ever happened to the Egyptians. But he either didn't know his history or chose to reject that history. And as a result, this disaster that's going to follow comes. He doesn't realize Joseph was their George Washington. Joseph was their Abraham Lincoln. Joseph was their Donald. Nah, never mind. He put Egypt on the map. He saved Egypt. He delivered Egypt during that 7-year period that would have completely wiped the nation out. That was Joseph. But oh, how quickly we forget our history. And I think the same thing has happened in our country. Don't you think so? Don't you think the same thing's going on in America right now? A bunch of people that don't know the godly history and heritage of America, one nation under God. They reject it. They remove it. They write and study revisionist history that takes God and that rich heritage away from our history. They don't know the profound belief systems of our founding fathers. They're not nearly half as smart as our founding fathers were. And yet, to the extreme, what are they doing right now? They're demonizing our founding fathers. And as they spit on the graves of our founding fathers and tear down the statues of our founding fathers, what they're doing is attempting to tear down the very foundation that the country was built on. It's serious stuff. Jesus said in the New Testament, that a house divided against itself will not stand. What do you suppose that does for the house that's destroying, tearing up its own foundation? Of course, it's not going to stand. And if this country doesn't take a different direction quick, this country is not going to stand either. United we stand, divided we fall. So this is what this new Pharaoh has done by either not knowing or rejecting Egypt's true history. Verse 9, and he said to his people, look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Verse 10, come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and it happen in the event of war, that they also join our enemies and fight against us, and so go up out of the land. Pharaoh's first problem was a lack of appreciation for the history of Egypt. Pharaoh's second problem was a military fear. Now, what was going on at this time is the Hittites up north were becoming a pretty formidable force, and that was making the Egyptians nervous. History tells us that Egypt had nothing to be concerned about, but they didn't know that. So based on this fear of the ever-growing strength of the Hittites up north and the potential for the Jews living there in Egypt to join forces to ally with the Hittites, they could be looking at a potential military mess. At this time, it's estimated that one in three people in Egypt, and pardon me, one in three people in Egypt were Jews. That's a huge number. Now, of course, we know this is paranoia. This is fear. This wasn't anything that they needed to be concerned about. And what this paranoia and fear did was lead to anti-Semitism. So that's the human perspective. That's the human explanation. That's the reason, physically, earthly, why the anti-Semitism that we're about to see in this book takes place. But we can track through all of the recorded events of anti-Semitism, and we can do the same thing. We can come up with all the human perspectives on them. We know the human perspective as to why Haman wanted all the Jews dead in the book of Esther. We know the human perspective on why King Herod wanted all the little Jewish baby boys there in Bethlehem destroyed. We know the human perspective on why Hitler wanted all the Jews killed there in Germany, which, by the way, was for the same reason of Exodus 1. It was a fear of the explosive growth and prosperity of the Jews. So we can look at all of those and we can extract the earthly reasons, the human perspectives, but here's what we really need to know. That is, if we don't know it already, anti-Semitism has always been Satan's number one strategy for trying to thwart God's plans. So you can slap a human face on it, you can throw some human reasoning behind it, but at its core, anti-Semitism is satanically and demonically inspired. Satan heard the promise of redemption there in Genesis 3, and he thought that Abel was the seed that the promise would come through, so he raised the little Cain and slew Abel. Satan heard the promise of God to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We get to Exodus 1. Satan fears that he's seeing that with his very own slitted, serpenty eyes coming to pass. So he raises up this sentiment of anti-Semitism to try to thwart God in that process. Same with Haman, Herod, Antiochus Epiphanes, Hitler, same with all of them. Before Christ, Satan inspired anti-Semitism to try to prevent that baby, that Messiah, that deliverer, that Savior from being born. And then when that baby was born, when Satan couldn't successfully stop that and that baby was born, Satan's method of anti-Semitism was for the purpose of extinguishing the life of the Messiah. And then when we fast forward to all of those post-resurrection occurrences of anti-Semitism, we might ask the question, Jesus came, Jesus died, he rose victoriously, what's left? Well, Satan's not done with anti-Semitism. There's only one thing left in his game plan, and that is to stop the nation of Israel, to try to wipe out the nation of Israel, or to try to overthrow the church so that God is thwarted in his plans to bring about all of the events that we read about in the book of Revelation. To disrupt the final establishment of the kingdom. I mean, if there's no one standing, if there's no one left when that comes to pass, it changes everything. But as we know, that's a battle Satan can't and won't win. Verse 11. Therefore, they set taskmasters over them. Taskmasters. I think that'd be a good title for our ministry workers. Taskmasters. You know, Rhonda, our women's ministry taskmaster. We got Tammy, our Sunday morning worship taskmaster. Of course, the pastor's a servant, but the rest of you will. Maybe we better just stick with the titles of servants and ministry workers. It was just a thought in passing. Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh supply cities, Python, and Ramses. So who was it that built Egyptian cities and pyramids? Well, if you watch the History Channel, they'll tell you it was the aliens. That's more reasonable to them, but we have the account right here. Sure, maybe the Egyptians did some of the work, but we know for a fact, biblically and archaeologically, that this was the work of the Jews. They had the Jews building these storehouse cities, building these pyramids. We're still confused about what they used the pyramids for. This was largely, ultimately, the work of the Israelites. But anyway, this was Pharaoh's solution to this potential threat of Israeli overthrow. And I have a serious problem with this solution. See, in my unsophisticated thinking, I'd say something like this. If we don't want this group of people to overthrow us, maybe we should kill them with kindness. Maybe we should endear ourselves to them. But that's not what the Pharaoh decided. The Pharaoh decided, we're not going to kill these people with kindness. We're going to kill these people with labor. We're going to have them work so hard and so long that they won't have time to organize and overthrow. And they won't have time to reproduce. We'll just get them worn out. We'll take up all their time and all their energy. By the way, this approach is the major problem that I have with our present day protesters and rioters. If you want to endear me to your cause, don't go out and burn the city down. Don't go out and riot and destroy and loot. To me, that's a declaration of war is what that is. That does not endear me to a cause or to a people group. That doesn't endear me to it. That's like a declaration of war. And that's what's happening here between Pharaoh and God. God sees this attempt as a declaration of war, and the Lord is going to show up and fight. So, if you're trying to endear yourself or your cause to the population, then endear yourself to the population through kindness instead of polarizing yourself through violence. Luckily, I don't think I have to preach that any harder to this fellowship. I don't think any of you have plans to go out rioting anytime soon. So, verse 12. The more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew, and they were in dread of the children of Israel. Why? We've covered this many times. Because you cannot curse what God has blessed. Genesis chapter 12, verse 3, Numbers chapter 23. Israel and the church have the same testimony on this one. God has blessed us, and no one can stop that blessing. We are a part of something that absolutely cannot fail. I mean, it just cannot fail. The Lord has promised the salvation of the nation of Israel. The Lord has promised the success of the church. So we're a part of something that we already know in advance is going to succeed. But here's a good question. Why would God allow the nation of Israel to be afflicted? Or maybe we could just bring this a little closer to home. Lord, why do you let people from the church, why do you let believers, why do you let saved people suffer affliction? It's simple. It's because God knows what every personal trainer on earth knows. God knows that if you want to build up your muscle strength and size, that it takes resistance training. It's the whole premise behind weightlifting. You get involved in resistance training. You work those muscles. And then after you work those muscles, you gorge yourself on everything that you can eat. And if you do both of those things, that's a combination for growth and strength. And God knows that the same thing applies spiritually. That for us to be strong people, for us to have spiritual might, it's going to take resistance training. And it's going to take gorging ourselves on the good food of the Word of God. That's the combination for growth as a Christian. You want to build your faith? It's going to take resistance training. You want to build your strength in the Lord? It's going to take resistance training. And that's what the Lord is doing here for the people of Israel in Egypt. I know we think that if the church was to suffer affliction and be persecuted, that it would hinder or harm the church. Isn't that the way we think naturally, physically? Like, Lord, if things got really intense on our church here, if we really suffered affliction from the world and persecution, I think that would make church life tougher. I think that would hinder our growth. That's what we think. But that's never what happens. Historically, that's not what happens when the church is afflicted or when the church is going through an intense time of persecution. Historically, what happens is that suffering, that affliction, that persecution causes the church to grow in two different areas, spiritually and numerically. Amazing. We see it in the Old Testament sense. In Exodus 1. In the New Testament sense, we see it right away in the book of Acts as that New Testament church is facing intense persecution. And yet, what happens to that New Testament church? It multiplies and grows, the same words that we see in Exodus 1. So, we've seen it in China in more modern days. We saw a fledgling church in China undergo intense persecution from their communist government. And the last we checked in with them, even though they've had to take church underground, the church in China didn't get weaker. The numbers in the churches in China didn't dwindle. No, they grew spiritually and they grew numerically. And I want you to know that if things don't change, that's what's going to happen to the church in America. What's going to happen is that the world is going to continue with Satan's usual plan of persecuting and afflicting the church, thinking that somehow that's going to hinder us or harm us in our growth. But what's going to happen is the exact opposite. We're going to be stronger spiritually, and we're going to grow in number. You just watch and see. It's why some wacko pastors actually pray that persecution would come to this country. Now, I'm not one of those. I pray for peace and freedom. But there are some people that pray that because they know what's going to happen. The church is going to get strong. The church is going to get serious. And people on the outside that you don't get their attention when things are smooth sailing, they look at the church in times like that. And they see the strength of the church and the determination of the church in spite of the efforts of persecution. And they go, wow, there's a cause that people believe so much that they're willing to put their necks on the line to continue. Maybe there's something to that. Well, we'll have to wait and see. But if persecution comes, and mark my words, the church is going to thrive. Verse 13. So the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor. 14. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar, in brick, and in all manner of service in the field. All their service in which they made them serve was with rigor. So they were hoping that rigor mortar would set in. So they made them serve with rigor and work in mortar, but the nation just continued to get healthier and healthier, stronger and stronger, more and more blessed, even as the workload, the affliction persisted. Verse 15. Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, of whom the name of one was Shiphrah, which means beauty, and the name of the other Puah, which I'm pretty sure it's Hawaiian. Puah, which means splendid. Verse 16, and he said, when you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stools, if it is a son, then you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live. So this was plan B, right? You realize we're on plan B. Plan A wasn't working. Plan B is full birth abortion, which, if you're paying attention, is no different than partial birth abortion. I know they use that terminology to try to take the sting off of it, but you still got a baby halfway out of the womb, and you can kill it at that moment. What's the difference of pulling it the rest of the way out and killing it? You're still killing a child. So this is full birth, post-birth abortion. Because the first plan wasn't working. Plan A was to give them a heavy workload, but they continued to grow. So plan B is just abort every male child that is born. That way, the population just freezes. There can be no procreation beyond that generation. They can completely freeze the population of the Jews. And then if they decide in the future that the population has come under control, they can lift that ban. Well, I just want you to know how big of a deal this was to the Lord. God would never forget that Egypt did this. In fact, it's going to end up being God's return favor, final approach in his final plague against the land of Egypt. He's going to turn this one right back on them. And he is going to kill all of their firstborn son on that night of that first Passover. God never lets this drop. And I think God takes it seriously. I guess this is a soapbox. I'll just claim it. I think God takes it seriously when he has plans to birth saved people and ministry workers and evangelists and pastors, and we as a people legalize abortion and abort those babies that God had plans for. Do you see that's why God gets so angry at this and turns this on Egypt? Because they're aborting his people. The real trick nowadays is that it's not just the Jews that are God's people. It's anyone that God eventually saves. And when you're aborting a child, you don't know God's plan for that child. We have probably aborted the world's finest evangelists and ministry workers, pastors and teachers. Can you imagine all of God's people that we've aborted in this country? I don't think God just winks at that. I don't think God just takes a pass at that and says, oh, well, I think that's serious to God. Well, I'll step down off that soapbox. Verse 17. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the male children alive. 18. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, why have you done this thing and saved the male children alive? 19. And the midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are lively. And they give birth before the midwives come to them. They're healthy. They're energetic. And those kids, they're out before we can even show up to help them. Now, verse 19 is an obvious lie, right? We all get that, don't we? I heard a very fine and well-meaning pastor try to defend that this was potentially a truth. I think that's the wrong approach for these verses because, well, he's wrong. It's just not true. We were told the truth in verse 17. The truth was they feared God more than they feared the edicts of the Pharaoh. And because they feared God, they intentionally saved the male children alive. The story they gave was a lie. Verse 19 was a lie. Let's read verse 20. Therefore, God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very mighty. Verse 21. And so it was because the midwives feared God that he provided households for them. So this is a tough one for some people to wrap their minds around, and it causes them to start asking dumb questions. Like, is it okay to lie? Have you never read the commandments? That's one of the big ones. Is it okay to lie in order to get the edge on your enemy? Maybe that's why this was okay, they say. Is it okay to lie when maybe your life is at stake? Maybe that's when it's okay to lie. Well, let me just clear up all those dumb questions. It's never going to be okay to lie. It's always going to be a sin to lie. It's not that the Lord is condoning the sin of lying here. It's simply that God is pardoning and commending them for the proper motivation, which was, we're not doing this because we fear God. We're not doing this because even if it puts us in danger, we're going to appreciate and preserve the sanctity of life. We're going to keep these Jewish boys alive. So, no, God is not condoning their lying. He is commending them for fearing him over the Pharaoh. Did they handle it perfectly? No. To handle this without failure, there was only one thing that they could have done. And that would be to go tell Pharaoh to suck on a lemon and just refuse to kill the Jewish male babies. And if that meant that they were killed, fine. If that meant that the Pharaoh was just going to keep moving along until he found midwives that were willing to do this, fine. All we know is that God would take care of it. All we know is that God's not going to let anything happen that he doesn't want to happen. So to do this without sin, that would have had to be their approach. But God, being merciful, he pardons the wrong and commends and blesses the right. And look how he blesses these two midwives. He gave them households. You know what that means? Midwives were usually barren. That's usually why a midwife was a midwife. It was usually because they were barren and couldn't have children themselves. So they devoted that time to help those women birth the children that those women could have. So that is quite possibly what's taking place here, that these midwives were barren and that the Lord opened their womb and blessed them with families. That's what's being said here. Maybe it was simply that they weren't married and that they were young ladies. And it could be that what this means is that the Lord brought along Mr. Right. Along comes Mr. Right, and soon comes the proposal, then comes the kids, then the regret. Why do I always go there? I'm sorry. But see, the Lord blessed them with families because of what they did. Verse 22. So Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, "Every son who is born, you shall cast him into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive." You know, this is plan C. You realize that, right? Plan A didn't work. They afflicted them. The nation grew even more under affliction. Then they charged the midwives to practice full birth abortion. And that didn't work. For some reason, those Jewish babies just kept getting born and just kept slipping past the system. So now we're on to plan C, which is a formal and national rule that all Egyptian and Israeli citizens are now deputized and given the authority to uphold the Egyptian government's rules. And here it is. Here's the rule. If you see someone not wearing a mask, turn them in. Oh, I'm sorry. No, I'm confusing that with information I read from Tom Wolfe earlier. I'm sorry. No, here was the plan. If you see a baby Jew, a baby boy Jew, throw it in the Nile. Drown it. No matter who you are. If you're an Egyptian citizen and you see a new baby Jewish boy, you toss it in the Nile and you drown it. If you're an Israeli, it's your civic duty. It's your duty to the government to take that Jewish boy baby and turn him over and toss him in. Well, I think you know how that's going to turn out, right? Tossing babies into that, I don't think that's going to work. So we're going to pick up at chapter 2 next week. I was really kind of hoping to get down to the first 10 verses of Exodus. I almost said Genesis. I've been saying Genesis for so long. I wanted to get down to the first 10 verses because in those first 10 verses, we get introduced to Moses, who is undoubtedly the star of this book. And I like how you got to keep in mind Moses is writing this, and the way he writes it in verse 2 is that when his mother Jochebed saw him, she saw that he was a beautiful child. I just think it's kind of fishy that he's the one writing this. I also think it's funny that we don't read about what Amram was thinking there. Sometimes dads tend to be a little more honest about that. Look at that baby for the first time and ugh. Did we do that? So we're going to take a look at that next week. We're going to get an introduction to Moses in the first handful of verses there. We're going to immediately then see him as an adult stepping into the role that God birthed him for. I really believe in that. I believe we're birthed with purposes from God. And I believe that once you get saved, if you really think back hard enough, even to your birth, you'll feel that call from God. Like all the way from the beginning to the present. God had a plan for Moses. God has a plan and a purpose for you. Nothing could stop God from working in Moses and the nation. Nothing can stop God from working in you to fulfill your purpose. Well, I guess nothing but you. So let's make sure we're not doing that. Let's make sure we're working together with the Lord. Would you stand with me?